Hello, I'm David Kale. I'm a solo performer and playwright. I'm doing a show called Lillian at Pangaea in New York City. And I'm talking with Rabbi Saul Solomon on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Oh, shalom, my friends. Shalom, my enemies. This is your old pal, Rabbi Saul Solomon, founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And if you know me, if you know this radio program of the air, you know that I love the theater. I love performance. I've done some performance myself. So I'm always curious about how actors and playwrights do what they do. Well, someone who's been doing what he's been doing for over 30 years now is David Kale, and he's all over the place right now, off Broadway in New York. For example, his play Harry Clark is now playing at the Vineyard Theater off Broadway. Plus, you can see him the third Sunday of every month at Pangaea down on 2nd Avenue around 5th Street. And you know why you should go there tomorrow? Well, to see his one-man show, Lillian, about a woman's love affair with a volatile young man. Ooh. We're going to ask him about Harry Clark. We're going to ask him about Lillian. We're going to talk to David Kale in the neighborhood. Shalom Dubit.
Hi.
Hi, how are you? Yes, you were a little taken aback by that introduction. Most people are. So
I love it.
So you're extremely... Is this busier than usual for you, or is it just you're more in New York now because you're usually doing stuff in Chicago and elsewhere?
It's the busiest I've ever been.
Ooh.
I have Harry Clark running with Billy Crudup at the Vineyard Theater. And I'm doing another show of mine on Pangaea, called Lillian, and then I have a show opening at the Public Theater in January called We're Only Alive for a Short Amount of Time, and then the third Sundays of each month at Pangaea, I do a singing show of all my songs, so it's really busy right now in a fabulous way. I'm really enjoying it.
Well, you've been at this for literally three decades. To what do you attribute the sudden burst of activity this past year?
It's mysterious to me. It's wonderful, and I don't know. I think I kept writing things when there was sort of less interest in what I was doing, and then there was 5 months ago there started to be some interest in putting on new shows of mine, and I had been writing all along through the time when there was sort of when people weren't so interested, so I had some things to work with, and suddenly they're all sort of popping up into production. It's really exciting.
Now, in the fallow times, how did you...
The fallow times, that's a very good way
I mean, did you have a great voice. Did you do voiceover work, or did you have to do jobs, or what?
No, I sometimes act in things, so I managed to sort of hang in there with between acting and occasionally performing, but it was a very sort of fallow time, and then the Vineyard Theatre, actually, my friend Sarah Stern, who's one of the co-artistic director of the Vineyard Theatre, she wrote to me on a Sunday, and she said, "Do you have anything?" This was in July, that could go into production in the fall at the theatre, and I sent her three scripts that I'd been working on, and they were all sort of ready to go. And Harry Clark happened very, very quickly. It's the fastest the show's ever gone into production. And it's audible.com. It's their first venture into theater. They're the co-producers of it. And then Billy Crudup, I wanted Billy Crudup to act in it. It was my dream scenario. And he was available. He wanted to do it. And it all kind of came together very quickly.
Well, tell us what Harry Clark is about. What's the plot?
It's about a very shy, timid guy from the Midwest who, growing up, could do a very good English accent and was convinced that he could be himself if he had an English accent. And he comes, but as a child, he has this character called Harry Clark that he does, who's this sort of very freewheeling, uninhibited Cockney guy, completely opposite to Philip, the boy. And when he moves to New York as 20-something-year-old and just presents himself as And all hell breaks loose.
Well, can I ask you, you are an actual English person, but how autobiographical is this story of an Englishman, per se, coming to New York?
It's not autobiographical, but I thought it would be, because I've done all these solo shows, I initially thought it might be kind of interesting if I did a show that presented me as, actually, I wasn't English. But then the character is American, and I thought, ultimately, I thought two things, that somebody else could perform it better, and that it would be better if it was an American pretending to be an English person, that it actually was what I'd written. So I had this other notion, which I haven't had with my other shows, that somebody else should perform it. And which was in line with the theater and Audible.com. We're also interested in recording a different actor performing. So it was, but it's not autobiographical.
Okay.
It's very sort of, I just followed my imagination. It's very from the imagination. I was just kind of, the story took on a life of its own and the characters took on a life of its own. And I just followed them where they led me.
Well, did you feel, when did you come to the States, and did you feel like a proverbial fish out of the Thames?
I came in 79, and I was 20 at the time, and I felt, I liked being, I'd always felt sort of alienated, like growing up in England, but I felt more comfortable being the a fish out of water, like really being it. It was actually kind of liberating for me in a way. And also America, New York, because I moved straight to New York City, and it was just much more encouraging to me, particularly artistically. And I found, like, I'd made friends in a way I hadn't made in England, and it was very nurturing for me. But I was kind of an odd bird.
And at that point, when you moved in 1979, did you already think you would be a theater person?
No, not at all. I thought I would be a singer. And then I started singing in clubs in New York and, like, just doing showcases. And it wasn't working, and I thought I should try and write my own songs. And I gave myself a deadline. There was a folk club in Folk City, a legendary folk club.
Sure, yeah.
Go Folk City. I saw they had an open mic on a Monday, I think it was, and you could get up and sing three original songs. And I set myself a deadline that I would, in a month, I would get a guitar, which I didn't know how to play, and figure out three songs. And I did that, and a writer friend of mine was in the audience, and he said, you should read these words at a poetry reading, that the words are more, they're better than the melodies. And I read them at St. Mark's Poetry Project in another open mic situation. But I was so frustrated from not having any kind of success artistically, but I sort of dramatically hurled these songs out, like they were little teeny monologues, dramatic monologues, and people were much more invested by them. And then somebody there said, take them to this theater, West Bed Theater in the West Village. They're doing an evening of this kind of thing. And before I knew it, I was doing monologues, but it was very organic, the way it happened, but it wasn't my intent. It just, one thing evolved out of another.
Well, what was your first complete solo show as a monologuist?
It was a show called The Red Throats that was at Performance Space 122.
Oh.
And the show did well and then reopened off-Broadway at Second Stage. And then it toured nationally. It went to the Goodman Theater. It was at the Mark Taper Forum. The Taper 2, a sort of smaller theater in Los Angeles. But it suddenly went to these major venues, and I was then known as a monologuist, but it wasn't what I had set out to do, and I'd never been trained as an actor. And there was no director on the shows. I was just figuring it out all by myself. And then the second show I did was called Smooch Music, and I added music to that and light
Well, speaking of music, you did appear two times on Broadway, one time in a musical. Back in 2006, you were in the revival of the Three Penny Opera that they had with Alan Cumming, and actually the woman who was on our show just last week, Brooke Sonny Moriber, was in that show along with Cindy.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Yeah, she was just our guest. We are total full disclosure. I have to say that the host of this radio program, Dave, saw that production, despised it, despises almost everything Wallace Shawn writes these days. But how did you enjoy being in Three Penny Opera? What was your character in there?
I was sort of Alan Cumming's, I was sort of part of his gang.
Oh, okay.
This side man. It was one of these things where it was a curious situation. I had a medical emergency going on that my blood was clotting in a very alarming way, and I did not have medical insurance. And I had seen a workshop of the Three Penny Opera, and I loved that show. I absolutely love it. But, you know, I wasn't going to be in it. And my friend Scott Elliott, who directed it, I mean, it was an incredible kind of gesture of generosity because I was running up enormous medical bills with no insurance. And I was injecting myself in the stomach with anticoagulants every day. You know, it was really a serious situation with my blood. And he said, I'll find something for you in the Three Penny Opera and you'll get medical insurance. And I really didn't want to do it, but the only reason, because I thought it's going to be really thankless, what am I going to do in the show? The third day, we hadn't been figured out exactly what I was going to do. But then I fell in love with it, and it got more and more interesting, and I loved the show, I loved performing in it, and I know it divided people tremendously, but I thought it was fabulous, and the music was out of this world, so this thing that I really didn't want to do, I ended up loving. I absolutely loved it.
Wow.
And the role, oddly, they kept adding to it to the point where, by the end of it, Equity stepped in and said, he's got to be redefined as a principal. They just kept adding little bits for me to do. So it ended up being a very satisfying experience for me, and incredibly generous on Scott's part that he did that, and it got me my medical insurance and the blood stopped clotting. And
I've got to say, that is a
we all lived.
How's your blood, by the way?
The blood's fine now.
Thank God.
It's really funny. There was one night where we got booed, and I've never been in a Broadway house where someone's booed, and I thought it was quite fascinating, and the cast was quite thrown by this. And then years later, I was in Berkeley. I had a show of mine called Palomino that was going to open in Berkeley, and they flew me out for a fundraising event and to sort of promote the show and what have you. And they introduced me as in this garden party, and the artistic director, Tom Ross of Aurora Theatre, he said, well, this is David. He was in the Three Penny Opera on Broadway. And then this guy came up to me, like a patron of the theater came up to me and said, I saw that show, I hated that production. In fact, I booed. But I met the booer.
You met
Berkeley.
The booer, that is...
Booer.
Wow. And what did you say anything to him? I mean, did you say, boy, that was not very nice, or...
I thought it was interesting that somebody had such a strong response. Well, I didn't take it personally, and I know there were some people loved the production. Many friends of mine loved it, and other people hated it.
But he booed at the end. He didn't boo during the show. He waited when...
We didn't take a curtain. We never took a bow, which irritated people. We just walked off the stage. But as soon as we walked off, there was this loud booing. And that the Studio 54, where that took place, was built as an opera house. And the acoustics are extremely good. So a boo can go a long way.
Wow, don't tell that to the roundabout. Because if they do a stinker there, anybody who's going to go see it knows, my boo's going to count now.
It will count.
Yeah.
But really, you know, we did one show with that. It was fabulous. There was one night where the computer crashed, or whatever controlled the sound. And
audience go crazy, happy.
Incredible. But you could do it in that theater because the acoustics were so good. But to hear, like, people like Cindy and Alan Cumming and Anna Gasteyer and, like, Nellie Mackay and Brooke, I mean, these fabulous singers with no enhancement, you can hear how great they are. That it's not trickery. It went from being one of those, like, the audience was getting very hostile to the audience feeling like they were at an event. It really was. It was an incredible night in the theater.
That sounds like I wish I'd seen
it. It was fabulous.
Seeing that. By the way, we're talking with David Cale, the actor, the performer. You can go see him live. Are you mic'd tomorrow night or un-mic'd?
I'm going to be mic'd.
You're going to be mic'd.
I'm in a tiny room, but I'm mic'd.
Yeah, the tiny room, by the way, is Pangea. It's at 178 2nd Avenue. I think that's around the 5th Street, East 5th Street there.
It's a bit up a bit, like I think between 11 and 12.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's opposite St. Mark's Church, pretty much.
Ah, so very near St. Mark's. And it's at, he's doing his one-man show called Lillian that you can see. But let me ask you, we're talking about Broadway. You do have one other Broadway credit on IBDB, I should say, that you were in a revival of Present Laughter, not the recent one with Kevin Kline, but you were understudying Frank Langella, as well as playing another main character in there. So how did that go? Did you ever go on as Ascendine?
I went on.
Yeah.
Well, I had my own role in the show. Frank got sick. We opened, I think, on a Tuesday. On Sunday night, Frank got really sick. The next Tuesday, I was on. And I'd never run the third act of the show till I was in front of the audience. There wasn't time. It was a three-hour show. I wasn't off book. I was, like, improvising. I didn't know the blocking.
Oh,
the three performances. The second play I'd ever been in. So it was, like, it was a wild experience.
Did the audience kind of, they got on your side? They knew? They were okay with it?
Yeah, the audience was really wonderful. And I got a very good response from the audience. But it was a show that was, Frank Langella is this, Frank Langella is that, Frank Langella is, you know, the reviews outside were all about Frank, and then suddenly Frank's not in it. So it was, but the audience was really generous, and you know, all three nights, I mean, people were standing at the end, and I got some really lovely notes from audience members about it.
Oh, good.
It was in a funny way, it was more, because I was used to doing monologues, and I'd never, you know, I'd only been in one other play, and it's, and that was a few months before Present Laughter. And this, because the Noel Coward play was really almost like it was such a sort of star vehicle, that in a way it was like a monologue with appendages. And there was something more familiar to me to drive the whole thing. That's what I was used to doing, but it was harrowing too, because I didn't know the script. I really wasn't off book properly, and I didn't know the blocking, so you had to sort of follow me around. And I didn't have any clothes. I was wearing some of Frank's clothes. It was very, like, an emergency situation. But it came, you know, it came out. It was very warmly received by the audience.
Good.
And the audience was very kind. So, and they had the opportunity. I mean, the deal was, you can come back and see Frank in it, but don't go, come and see David. And people stayed.
That's wonderful. I mean, I'm glad, because, you know, actors, the famous ones, they tend to get post-opening itis, invariably. They build up, they're working, they're great, they go through previews, the critics see it, they get through opening night, and then somehow, magically, they come down with leukemia the next week.
Yeah, they get sick, yeah.
Yeah.
But what was also complicated for me was that we opened, and I wasn't reading any reviews on the show, but I came in, and Frank and I were very close, and I mean, he was very, very kind to me and sweet.
Oh, good.
And he was like, how are you? Are you okay? And I was like, Frank, I don't read reviews. But then I read the reviews. I got terrible reviews. So it was really terrible. And then a few days later, I'm in the lead. So it was a very peculiar situation that, for, I think, everybody involved, that I was just not well received in my little part. But then suddenly, a few days later, literally, I'm in Frank's role. So, and very inexperienced with, you know, I'd never been trained as an actor. And it's Broadway. I mean, it's just
right,
an 1,100-seat house. It was wild. I mean, it was like the actor's nightmare, in a way.
It really, I mean, especially since...
But I didn't think of myself as an actor, so hey, yeah. And I was very ambivalent about it. And I said no originally when they asked me to understudy. I said, I didn't want to do that. And I wasn't sure if I wanted to do the play either. I mean, as much as I love the play, but it took me out of my own work for a year. I think the contract was for a year, and I was, you know, I wanted to do my own work. So it was a little bit of a, and I wasn't pursuing an acting career on stage. I was in movies. I wanted to do movies. I wanted to do my own work. But I was very sort of ambivalent about acting on stage. I just want outside my own work.
I mean, it's just so funny to hear you say this, because there are 12,000 other actors who have been in your position and would have cut your throat to understudy. Yeah, I would have. I would have used a kosher.
No, I would love to do it. I mean, that would be different. But at the time, I was like, plays would come along, and I just didn't want to do them. I just wanted to do my own work. I mean, I had enough with my own work, and I was also very busy at the time, and I was touring a lot. And I had a long relationship with the Goodman Theater.
Oh, yeah.
I'd done six shows with them. The three of them they commissioned, and I'd done a lot of stuff in San Francisco. So it was taking me out of my own work.
So
I wasn't sure how I felt about it initially. It was, as much as I loved the play and I loved Noel Coward and strongly identify with him, and we have the same birthday. Tomorrow's his birthday, and tomorrow's my birthday.
Oh, mid Basel.
December 16th, whenever. I was the same age as Noel Coward was when he wrote that play, and I write songs. There were many. I really relate to Noel Coward. So in a funny way, it was more accurate casting. I can't do what Frank does. I mean, Frank was dazzling in it. But it was, in a way, it was more accurate in terms of I was English. I had a lot of things in common with, superficially at least, with Noel Coward.
By the way, let's wish a Yom Huledet Sameach to our friend of the neighborhood, David Gale. Happy birthday. So how old are you now?
59.
Oh, my goodness. Mit Mazel, mit Glück. So, let me ask, do you have any special birthday plans, or do you have any plans for 60?
I'm doing a show on my birthday. Well, I'm hoping. I'm in Massachusetts right now at Massmocha with the Sundance Theatre Lab, and we're going to do a presentation of this new musical that we're doing at the Public Theatre on January 11th in Under the Radar, the Under the Radar Festival.
Oh, cool.
So we're going to try it out tomorrow.
Can I ask you, David Kell, having gone through New York theater and Chicago theater as well in the 80s and 90s, how is it different? How has it morphed, if at all, to the way off and off Broadway is now?
How is it different?
Yeah. I mean, is it the same feeling like when you came to New York and you made all these friends and you were part of theater for the new city, and I'm sure you were doing stuff at La Mama and that those environs and things... Is it different now, or what?
There were definitely more venues. There were more performance, sort of, for want of a better word, sort of alternative venues. I think the first show that I did ran off Broadway without anybody working on it but me. I don't think that would be so possible now.
Mm.
It was, I think there's more input generally from, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how much it's changed, really. I think the theater in generally is in a golden period. I think there's more exciting young writers and directors and designers and actors than ever. It's definitely the most exciting period that I've ever experienced, and I don't quite understand why it's not been noted. It's very evident to me. There's so many exciting young writers and directors.
Huh.
But I used to go out beautifully to theater, and there was so much I just wasn't engaged by. Now I just see one good thing after another. I think it's such a golden period. It feels like TV is having such a golden time.
Right. Yeah.
I feel the theater is too.
Now, can I ask your process? You think of an idea for one of your one-person shows, right? How What is the timeline? How long does it take from the basic idea, the spark, to writing it and then revising it and then memorizing it and performing it? What, how does that go?
Yeah, it takes a few years.
Wow.
To get a script. It really is. But the thing about it is, I mean, I noticed, like, particularly right now, I mean, I'm writing a lot of songs, but my collaborator, Matthew Dean Marsh, is very quick, and he's young, he's 29, and his mindset is, okay, I'll talk to him, and he'll say, okay, bring a new song over tomorrow. And what would ordinarily take me a month or 2 months, I'll write by tomorrow. And I find that I can actually write much quicker if somebody is actually putting a fire under me or giving me a deadline.
Right.
But where I've taken years to write things, I think if somebody said, we need a show for January 21st, we need a script, and if I had nothing else to do, I could probably come up with something. Probably the same amount as if somebody said, you have till 2020 to write this.
Deadlines are the great motivator. They really are. There's something about them. Everything
the
else falls away, and you get into a workload.
I need
work
it,
mode.
Yeah. Also, when somebody, because I procrastinate a lot, and I've just gotten better at procrastinating and more sophisticated with it, and it's like, yeah, and time, you know, we don't have all the time in the world, obviously, and it's like, I want to be doing things, and I want to be as productive and force myself to do as much as possible and really challenge myself, so having, it's very good for me to collaborate with people that expect me to come up with something quickly, or just come up with something. I don't have the excuse of saying I didn't have an idea. Yeah, I have to have an idea.
Speaking of ideas, delivers,
even if it's a bad one,
oh yeah,
it's got to be something.
Can I ask, over the years now, as you said, you're seeing more and more good theater than when you're going to see your friends and colleagues and cohorts perform and stuff, but what are the have been the most life-changing theatrical experiences that you've gone to see over the past 30, 40 years?
The most life-altering...
Well, the ones that really knocked your socks off.
The first one, in a very, very substantial way, was Bette Midler in the 70s, where I saw her, I saw all six performances that she did in England. I saw all of them. I saw three of them from the front row, and that was life-altering.
Well, it was life-altering because at some point you wound up in her Mondo Biondo TV show.
Well, that was that, too. But I had never seen a performer that was moving, funny, one minute, very affecting and emotional the next, could kind of unify a group of... She was like, it was like a performer as liberator. Ooh. I'd never seen anything like it. It was astonishing. It was life-affirming. It unified this group of strangers in the audience. She was galvanizing. She were in tears one minute, and then you were laughing the next. She was absolutely extraordinary, and I'd never seen anything like it. And I thought, that's what I want to do in my way, however I can do it. That's my dream of being.
So how did you go from...
What she's doing to me,
yeah,
I want to do to other people.
Wow. But how you went from watching her in the front row as a spectator, as a fan, and then actually meeting her and being on a show that had Bill Irwin and the Kipper Kids. Well, one of those was her husband. But how did you get involved with what she was doing?
I did a show at the Kitchen in New York City called Smooch Music, and my friend Scott McCauley, who was the artistic director of the theater at the time, or the Performance Bedwood Arts Center, called me and said that Bette and her husband, Martin, her husband had been looking at videos of me.
Oh.
And then she asked me to be a guest on, what the producers or whoever it was that asked me to be a guest on her show, and it was really incredible for me. I mean, it was a profound experience. I mean, that she came back into my life in such a way. And, you know, it's my... manager of Hello Dolly, so she saw her back in my life. And he was the production stage manager on I'll Eat You Last, her solo show. So we've sort of crossed paths a couple of times since.
Oh, and is she as nice in person as she seems?
Oh, she's fabulous. I love her.
Yay.
Love her so much. And that she's so enjoyable in that show. I mean, the Hello Dolly.
I've heard the producer, the host of this radio program, saw Hello Dolly with her a few months, and it's a wonderful production. Just hilarious.
I've seen it three times. It's an event. It's an experience. She's incredible. There's no one like her. She's an absolute original, and her powers are in.
Sense that.
And then other people I was around, because there were a lot of people doing interesting things, people like Karen Finley, I was very taken by, and Holly Hughes, and Spalding Gray, and you know, Eric Bogosian. There was a lot of stuff going on that you just kind of fed you and inspired you, and it was a very fertile period in New York in the 80s. There was a lot of people expressing themselves. John Paley, very interesting performers, very original, and it was inspiring. There was a lot to be inspired by, and there was also a lot of support for it and interest in it. And it was a very, you don't realize it at the time, but it was a very fertile period artistically in New York City.
Now,
what's going on?
A fair question to ask then, since you've said that you're seeing so much good work now, apart from seeing Bette Midler and Hello Dolly, what is something over the past, let's say, 2 or 3 years that rocked your world?
I love Annie Baker's work. I love The Flick. I saw The Flick several times. I love Max Posner's writing. His play The Treasurer that just closed the Playwrights Horizons. I love Claire Barron. Her writing, I think, is wonderful. Sarah DeLapp, her play The Wolves, I love that. Who else do I particularly? Oh, that A Doll's House Part 2, I thought was fantastic, incredibly acted and directed and designed. These kind of things, I feel I've left theater. I've been seeing shows repeatedly.
Okay.
In a way that I didn't, that kind of thing never used to happen. I mean, it happened with Joseph Chaykin or Charles Ludlam's work, I would see repeatedly, or and performance, some of the, like Laurie Anderson, I've seen many, many times. But but in terms of plays, I mean, nowadays, if I like something, I'll just go back and see it again.
And there's
a whole slew of interesting writers and designers and directors and interesting actors, some really interesting actors running around. So I think it's a really great period for theater.
Well, speaking of interesting actors and writers to go see and to go see over and over again, let me remind everybody that you can see David Cale every month, the third Sunday?
The third Sunday of every month.
At Pangea.
Soon.
On 2nd Avenue around 11th Street, East 11th Street. This particular Sunday, tomorrow, you can go see him in his one-person show, Lillian, although usually if you go see him in January, February, March, he's going to be doing his music stuff. And each one of those will be different. It'll be a whole different set.
Each month is different. It's called Songs for Charming Strangers. I do it with my collaborator, Matthew Dean Marsh, and we have different musicians each time. Each month is going to be a different song. It's pretty much all original. And it will just, it's going to be, every month will be fresh and new, and I just want to be playful with it all. So,
And by the way, if you want to impress people in terms of your songwriting ability, a couple of your songs have been performed in concert by no less than Elvis Costello. Yes?
That's true.
How did your songs get to him?
I worked on an album with a producer, Hal Wilner, a great record producer, a record called The Jazz Passengers in Love, that was a jazz band, The Jazz Passengers, doing their first vocal album, and they asked me to write some of the lyrics, and each track had a different singer on singing the songs, and it was quite an eclectic mix of people from Mavis Staples to Jeff Buckley to Debbie Harry and Jimmy Scott. It was a very eclectic mix, and Elvis Costello heard the album and liked the album and started doing sort of guest spots with the band, and so he started singing. He sang, I think, three of my songs over at different times. You know, and it was sort of an ongoing thing. He's very, very supportive. He's a very supportive artist. You know, he's. Mm. Was very supportive of the Jazz Passengers and Roy Nathanson, the band's leader. Very supportive person.
Yeah. Yep. Actually, you mentioned Deborah Harry. She did one of your songs.
Five or six at least.
Ooh.
I wrote a few for her that she recorded. And she became the band's singer. The Blondie was sort of on pause for a while. And so she was touring around with the band, and she is incredible. I mean, she's an incredible human being and an incredible inspiration to me.
Oh.
The way she is in the world and her artistic life. She's a great lyricist, too. I always felt she was sort of it's very easy to overlook what a good lyricist she is. I mean, a lot of these Blondie songs, she's the lyricist, and her lyrics with Chris Stein's music. But she's someone I adore. I really adore.
And another person I want to bring up who's done your songs is Richard Butler of the Psychedelic Furs.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. That was really exciting for me. I love the Psychedelic Furs. And we were in the studio for a day. And he's only recorded, I think, a vile track on Lost in the Stars. It had another Hal Wilner record. But he was not. He only recorded with the Psychedelic Furs. I think it was the second song that he'd ever sung that wasn't a Psychedelic Furs song, and he's got that voice. It's so distinct. Yeah. I was in heaven that day with him. A fabulous singer and a lovely man too. Very interesting. He's a visual artist too. He's an interesting person too. It was really an honor to have that experience with him.
Well, it has been an honor to be experiencing the presence and the voice of David Kale. Dubik, I have two more quick questions for you before we let you go. First of all, gotta ask, because I ask this of everyone, are you Jewish?
No, but...
Oh, damn it.
But many people think I am. I have many, many Jewish friends.
Well, you're in theater. Of course you have Jewish friends. You have Jewish friends...
Before that, I always did as a little kid, even in England, where there weren't so many Jewish people. I managed to be taken in by the Jewish families.
Yay. And let me ask also, having a career the way you do, of all these years of being a solo artist and actor, having to travel, going, which is wonderful to travel, but how does that work in terms of relationships? Are you partner? Do you have you been? Where are you in that personal sense?
Right now, I'm like without, but I was with somebody for 27 years who was Jewish, Israeli.
Israeli?
Yes.
So what happened?
I blew it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I messed up.
are you kidding? Or
it ended. No, I'm kidding. No, I'm not kidding, actually. I did. It's probably my fault that it ended. But it's, so I'm back to shows.
Well, so are you looking? Are you dating? Or are you
dating my shows? I'm going out with my shows.
All right. Hey, when the time is right.
I'm dinner with my shows.
You'll meet another Jewish person, and you never know.
You never know. You never know. It's really true.
Well, what I do know is that you should all go see Harry Clark at the Vineyard Theater. It's playing for one more week off-Broadway. And, of course, go see tomorrow David Kale at Pangea over on 2nd Avenue. To find out more about him, he does have a Facebook page. It's DavidKale.98, I think is the thing, because there's a bunch of David Kales. But he's the one with the black and white picture of a creepy-looking kid with a bird on his head.
That's me. That's not a creepy-looking kid.
It's a creepy-looking photo. I'm sorry. It's just, it looks like the Children of the Damned sort of photo. It does. I'm just telling you. You're a good-looking... I mean, it's Beatles-esque, but still a little bit like, ooh. Maybe it was in color. Maybe. I don't know. Anywho, but it's been an absolute pleasure talking to David Kale in the Daybreak. I wish you further success with all the projects that you're doing, and shalom to you.
Oh, thank you so much, yeah. Bye-bye.